This is a Kim Monson National News Briefing. Illegal immigration, how the world got here. Denver immigration dominated the 2024 presidential election like no issue in a generation. 6 in 10 voters called it very important to their vote. And by December 2023, 35% of Americans named it the country's biggest problem, surpassing even inflation for the first time. A record 14 million unauthorized immigrants lived in the United States as of 2023, and 78% of Americans called the situation at the southern border either a crisis or a major problem. But the forces that created this moment stretch back more than a century. Understanding them requires tracing a history of policies that repeatedly produce consequences their architects never intended. An enforcement system that grew exponentially without solving the underlying problem, and a legal immigration framework so broken that waiting in line is, for millions, not a realistic option. This is the story of how America arrived at this point. On the origins of immigration law in America. For most of American history, there was no such thing as illegal immigration because there were no immigration laws to break. The United States maintained functionally open borders for its first century. Anyone who could make the journey could stay. That changed with the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, the first law in American history to bar an entire national group from entering the country. Signed by President Chester A. Arthur, the act prohibited Chinese laborers from immigrating and denied Chinese residents the ability to become citizens. It was renewed, made permanent in 1902, and not repealed until 1943, when China became a wartime ally. The Immigration Act of 1924 went further, capping annual immigration at roughly 165,000 and establishing per-country quotas pegged to the 1890 census. The formula was designed to preserve the existing ethnic composition of the United States, favoring immigration from Britain and Western Europe, while sharply limiting arrivals from Southern and Eastern Europe and excluding Asia entirely. The act shut out most European Jews and other refugees fleeing fascism in the decades that followed. The same year, Congress created the Border Patrol with an initial force of 450 inspectors. Turning to the Brasairo Bargain and its aftermath. During World War II, facing severe agricultural labor shortages, the United States and Mexico established the Brasairo program. Between 1942 and 1964, more than 4.5 million Mexican workers entered the country under temporary work contracts. The program created deep networks of migration between the two countries that would persist long after the program ended. In 1954, the Eisenhower administration launched Operation Wetback, a mass deportation campaign that the government claimed removed 1.3 million people, though historians estimate the actual number was closer to 300,000. The operation used military-style tactics. Agents raided Mexican-American neighborhoods, demanded identification from Mexican-looking citizens, and invaded private homes. American citizens and legal residents were swept up in the dragnet. In Texas, deportees were packed onto boats later, compared to slave ships. When the Brasairo program ended in 1964, the workers did not stop coming. They continued crossing the border to fill the same jobs, but now without legal authorization. On the law that created illegal immigration from Latin America. The Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, known as the Hartzeller Act, is remembered for abolishing the discriminatory national origins quotas. But it also did something its sponsors did not anticipate. It created the legal framework for mass unauthorized immigration from Latin America. Before 1965, there were no numerical restrictions on immigration from the Western Hemisphere. The Hartzeller Act imposed a cap of 120,000 visas, later reduced to 20,000 per country in 1976. As historian Jane Hong of Occidental College wrote, whole groups of migrants from Mexico and Latin America whose entrance to the U.S. would have been considered legal before 1965 suddenly became illegal. The results were immediate and dramatic. the number of apprehensions per 1,000 Border Patrol agents rose from roughly 40,000 in 1965 to a peak of approximately 460,000 in 1977. What had been a routine, circular flow of workers crossing back and forth became, almost overnight, a new category of law-breaking. Turning to the enforcement paradox, Massey's research revealed something counterintuitive about the response that followed. As the United States invested more in border enforcement, the unauthorized population grew faster, not slower. The reason was simple: enforcement disrupted the circular pattern. When crossing became more difficult and dangerous, migrants who had previously gone home after seasonal work stopped leaving. Although the inflow of undocumented Mexicans was largely unaffected by border enforcement, Massey wrote, the outflow was drastically curtailed as migrants shifted from a circular to a settled pattern of migration. By the mid-1980s, the undocumented population had reached 3 to 5 million people, prompting the first major legislative response on Reagan's amnesty and the pattern it set. The Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, signed by President Ronald Reagan, attempted a grand bargain: legalize those already here while making it harder for new unauthorized immigrants to come. Approximately 2.7 million people received permanent residence. The law also made it illegal for employers to knowingly hire undocumented workers, with penalties of $250 to $10,000 per violation. Multiple studies found that the amnesty itself did not encourage illegal immigration in the long term, but it failed to stop it either. Employer sanctions went largely unenforced, and the underlying mismatch between labor demand and legal immigration slots remained unchanged. The pattern of attempting legalization plus enforcement, followed by failure to sustain either, would repeat for the next four decades. Turning to prevention through deterrence. The 1990s brought a fundamental shift in border strategy. In 1993, Border Patrol Chief Silvestre Reyes mobilized 400 agents along 20 miles of border in El Paso in Operation Hold the Line, producing a 70% drop in local apprehensions. The following year, the Clinton administration launched Operation Gatekeeper at the San Diego-Tijuana corridor. The strategy was called Prevention Through Deterrence: erect barriers and urban crossing points, and push migrants into remote, dangerous terrain where they would, theoretically, stop trying. What happened instead was that they kept trying in more dangerous places. In the Tucson sector of Arizona, migrant deaths rose from 14 in 1994 to 90 in 2000 to 163 in 2002. Border officials, according to researchers, knew that death would be an element of this new militarized enforcement-only track. That same year, Congress passed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996. Among its provisions were the 3-year and 10-year bars. Anyone out of legal status for more than 180 days would be barred from re-entry for 3 years, more than a year, barred for 10. The provision was meant as a deterrent. In practice, it trapped millions of people in the shadows. Undocumented immigrants who might have returned home and applied for legal entry now face the prospect of a decade-long exile from their families. Many chose to stay on a system designed to fail. The legal immigration system that these enforcement measures were meant to protect is itself deeply dysfunctional. The mismatch between the system's capacity and the demand it faces explains much of why people come illegally. The United States issues only 5,000 green cards per year for low-skilled workers in a labor market that absorbs roughly 300,000 unauthorized workers annually. For workers without family connections or employer sponsors, there is often no line to get in. For those who do have a path, the wait can span decades. Nearly 4 million people sit in the family-sponsored backlog. Mexican and Filipino applicants in certain categories face 19 to 24-year waits. The employment-based backlog has reached a record 1.8 million, with Indian workers in some categories facing projected waits of more than 90 years. For every $24 the federal government has spent on ICE and Border Patrol since 2003, it has allocated just $1 to the immigration court system that adjudicates these cases. The scale of the mismatch helps explain a fact that often surprises Americans. As of 2017, an estimated 46% of undocumented immigrants had entered the country legally on a visa and overstayed. They did not sneak across a border. They came through the front door and found it impossible to leave. Turning to the $409 billion question. Since the creation of the Department of Homeland Security in 2003, the United States has spent a combined $409 billion on CBP and ICE. The Border Patrol grew from 4,139 agents in 1993 to 19,357 in 2022. The agency's budget tripled from $5.9 billion to $19.6 billion. ICE spending nearly tripled as well, from $3.3 billion to $9.6 billion. Physical barriers expanded from 14 miles of fencing in San Diego in 1990 to more than 650 miles under the Secure Fence Act of 2006, signed by President George W. Bush with bipartisan support. President Trump's first term added 458 miles at an average cost of roughly $20 million per mile, about five times more expensive per mile than Bush-era fencing. The vast majority of Trump-era construction replaced existing barriers with taller or more formidable structures. During this same period, the unauthorized population grew from roughly 10 million to a record 14 million. That figure does not mean enforcement had no effect, it likely would have been higher without it. But the numbers illustrate a fundamental reality. Enforcement alone has not solved the problem. On the legal-illegal divide and what Americans actually think. The most revealing polling on immigration is not the question about whether there should be more or less of it. It is the question that separates legal from illegal. In 2024, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs found that 77% of Americans favored maintaining or increasing legal immigration. The same year, 78% told Pew Research Center that the situation at the southern border was either a crisis or a major problem. Those numbers are not contradictory. They are the same electorate saying two things at once: keep the legal door open, close the illegal one. AP NORC polling sharpened the distinction further. Roughly 60% of Americans said legal immigrants benefit the economy, while only 42% said the same of undocumented immigrants. The gap held across party lines. Americans do not oppose newcomers, they oppose disorder. That pattern showed up in the Gallup swing of 2024 to 2025. In June 2024, amid record border encounters, 55% wanted immigration decreased. By June 2025, after the Trump administration's enforcement campaign dropped border crossings 95%, that figure fell to 30%. Simultaneously, a record 79% told Gallup that immigration is a good thing for this country, the highest percentage in the poll's history. Americans did not change their minds about immigration. They reacted to whether the system appeared to be under control. The bipartisan consensus on specific policies runs deeper than the rhetorical partisan divide overall suggests. 80% of Americans, including strong majorities of both parties, support a path to legal status for Dreamers who were brought to the country as children. The Harvard CAPS Harris poll found 75% support for deporting immigrants convicted of crimes and 63% for closing the southern border. The Lake and Riley Act, mandating detention of undocumented immigrants charged with certain crimes, passed the Senate 64-35, with 12 Democrats voting yes. A Quinnipiac poll found 64% favoring a legal pathway for undocumented immigrants already in the country. 68% supported mandatory E-Verify for all employers. These numbers suggest a partisan divide narrower than cable news implies. Both sides agree on more than they fight about. Legal immigration is good, illegal immigration is a problem, enforcement should target criminals first, the legal system should be fixed, and people brought here as children deserve a path forward. Hispanic and Latino opinion, often treated as monolithic in political coverage, is considerably more complex. In a 2024 Axios Ipsos poll, 42% of Latinos supported building a border wall, up from 30% in 2021. nearly 48% backed Trump in the 2024 election, the highest Republican share of the Latino vote in modern history. At the same time, 73% believed mass deportations would tear families apart, and, by late 2025, 70% of Hispanics disapproved of Trump's handling of immigration. Turning to a global consensus, legal, yes, illegal, no. America's immigration debate often proceeds as if the country's challenges are unique. They are not. Every major democracy on Earth is grappling with the same tensions, and the public opinion data from these countries converges on the same conclusion. People support legal immigration and oppose illegal immigration. In the United Kingdom, YouGov found a 31-point gap. 48% said legal immigration was too high, but 79% said the same of illegal immigration. That gap drove the 2016 Brexit vote, where immigration was among the strongest reasons for leaving the European Union. In a paradox that illustrates the difficulty of the issue, the UK has attracted significantly more migrants since Brexit than before it. Across Europe, a 2024 YouGov survey of seven nations produced a finding that captures the distinction at its sharpest. Between 78% and 91% of respondents in each country supported deporting immigrants who had come to claim benefits, and 66% to 85% backed removing irregular asylum seekers. But when asked whether they would deport an immigrant who worked as a doctor or nurse with a valid visa, only 8% to 12% said yes. The line people draw is not about the person, it is about the legal status. Germany's decision to register more than 1 million asylum seekers in 2015 under Chancellor Angela Merkel's "We Can Do This" declaration fueled the rise of the far-right Alternative for Germany party. 7 EU member states now have far-right parties in government, with immigration as the animating issue. Hungary took the opposite approach, erecting a 175-kilometer barbed wire fence on its border with Serbia and refusing EU refugee quotas. The EU-Turkey deal of 2016, which paid Turkey 6 billion euros to stem the flow, reduced irregular crossings from 885,000 to roughly 42,000 in 2 years, but produced overcrowded camps on Greek islands and barely 2,000 actual returns. In Australia, 88% support skilled migration through the country's points-based system, according to the Scanlon Foundation, while 69% support the government's policy of turning back boats carrying unauthorized arrivals, according to the Lowy Institute. Australia pioneered offshore processing, forcibly transferring asylum seekers to detention centers on Nauru and Papua New Guinea. The policy drew international condemnation after an asylum seeker was killed in detention. Its deterrent effect, researchers found, came primarily from military interdictions at sea rather than the detention itself. Canada, long held up as a model of managed immigration through its points-based express entry system, saw support erode once the system appeared to lose control. Immigration accounted for nearly 98% of Canada's population growth in 2023. Irregular crossings at Roxham Road in Quebec became a political flashpoint. The Environics Institute found that 58% of Canadians felt too many immigrants were being accepted. Ottawa slashed permanent resident targets from 500,000 to 365,000 by 2027 and cut international student admissions nearly in half. Japan presents the starkest version of the paradox. A Yomiuri Shimbun poll found 59% of Japanese opposed accepting more foreign workers, with 68% worried about public safety and 63% citing cultural friction. Yet facing severe labor shortages from an aging population, the country set a record of 2.3 million foreign workers in 2024 and announced plans to accept 1.23 million more through 2028. The public resists the idea of immigration, while the economy cannot function without it. The pattern extends to Latin America, where it is rarely discussed. In Chile, Atlas Intel found 92% and 96% supported stricter immigration controls as Venezuelan migration surged. In Colombia, 68% supported stricter immigration controls, as Atlas Intel found in a survey for Bloomberg News. Mexico deployed 6,000 troops to its Guatemala border and nearly 12,000 National Guard members to its southern region. Enforcement intensified dramatically after the Trump administration threatened tariffs on Mexican goods in 2019. Globally, immigration ranked as a top three concern in 19% of countries surveyed by the Ipsos What Worries the World Tracker, the highest level recorded. Of the 123.2 million people now forcibly displaced worldwide, low- and middle-income countries host 71%. The numbers from every continent say the same thing. People welcome legal immigration and reject illegal immigration. No country has figured out how to deliver both at once. On Denver, and what 42,000 arrivals cost a city. When the first bus of roughly 100 migrants pulled into Denver on December 7, 2022, city officials scrambled to open an emergency shelter overnight. Over the next 18 months, more than 42,000 migrants would arrive, roughly 6% of the city's population, making Denver the fourth highest recipient per capita in the country. Roughly half of the 42,000 arrivals remained in the Denver metro area, according to city estimates cited by the Common Sense Institute. Texas Governor Greg Abbott had added Denver to his busing program, declaring that overwhelmed and overrun border communities should not have to shoulder the flood. More than 19,200 migrants arrived on Texas buses before the last one rolled in during June 2024. An estimated 40% to 60% of those who arrived wanted to go elsewhere but lacked the resources to continue. The city purchased roughly 20,000 bus tickets to send arrivals to other cities. The bill came fast. Denver spent more than $79 million in direct city funds on migrant services. When education costs $228 million for 16,197 migrant students across metro districts and uncompensated hospital care, $49 million across 16,760 emergency room visits are included, the Common Sense Institute estimated total regional costs at $356 million. City agencies disputed that figure as inflated, but the city's own direct spending was enough to reshape daily life for existing residents. Mayor Mike Johnston ordered $45.5 million in budget cuts across every city department to fund the response. Recreation centers reduced hours. The DMV stopped offering in-person vehicle registration renewals. Parks programming was cut 25%. Spring flower beds were eliminated. Denver Health, the city's safety net hospital, saw uncompensated care surge to $136 million in 2023, rising to $174.7 million in 2024, a 28% increase, and closed 15 inpatient beds for substance abuse and mental health treatment. CEO Donna Lynn told the city council the crisis was going to break Denver Health. The money flowed through a network of nonprofits and hotel contracts with minimal accountability. The Salvation Army received $27.2 million, the Denver Rescue Mission $19.8 million, and Catholic Charities $17.6 million for combined homeless and migrant shelter operations. BV Wellness received approximately $10.4 million for case management and housing navigation. Papagayo received $3.9 million. Centro Humanitario received $2.85 million for workforce training. Quebec Hospitality LLC received $25 million for hotel rooms at $90 to $120 per person per night. The city purchased a Best Western for $26 million and a former DoubleTree Hotel for $43 million to convert into shelters. In November 2024, Denver's city auditor reported that the Department of Housing Stability could not provide a comprehensive financial breakdown of nearly $150 million in taxpayer funds spent on the shelter system. More than 50% of reviewed invoices were submitted late. 38% lacked proper documentation. Some included duplicate payments. And what did the spending produce? The data is remarkably thin. Denver's formal asylum seekers program served 860 people out of 42,000 arrivals, roughly 2%. Centro Humanitario's Work Ready program trained 500 migrants in construction and hospitality, the city projected these graduates would generate $20 million for the local economy. Actual employment data was never published. The city does not track what happens to migrants after they leave its programs. There's no public accounting of how many of the 42,000 arrivals achieved stable employment and housing, how many moved on, or how many disappeared into the informal economy. Denver's existing homeless population, which had already grown 32% to roughly 10,000 people in 2023, watched resources redirect to newcomers. At food banks and shelters, aid workers reported flaring tensions between migrants and the unhoused, including shoving matches over donated clothes. If you can all of a sudden come up with all these millions of dollars to address their housing, one local bakery owner told ProPublica, "Why didn't you address the homeless issue here?" Suburban communities pushed back. Douglas County, El Paso County, Weld County, and Aurora all took steps to prevent spending public funds on migrant services. Parts of the response worked. When the first bus arrived, city officials stood up an emergency overnight shelter within hours, a logistical achievement that received little attention. The Work Ready training program placed graduates into construction and hospitality jobs. The bus ticket program moved thousands of arrivals to cities where they had family or sponsors, reducing long-term demand on Denver's shelter system. But these successes were overshadowed by the scale of what followed: Mayor Mike Johnston's handling of the crisis and increasing federal scrutiny. A timeline of his public statements and policy decisions shows a pattern of escalating confrontation with federal authorities. In November 2024, Johnston told Denverite he was prepared to send Denver police to the county line to block federal deportation forces, invoking Tiananmen Square and saying he was willing to go to jail. He walked it back on 9 News within days. "Would I have taken it back if I could? Yes." The Denver Post editorial board scolded him for amping up violent rhetoric and called it wrong to threaten armed conflict to protect immigrants. In March 2025, he testified for 6 hours before the House Oversight Committee. The city paid Covington & Burling, a Washington law firm, $2 million for that single appearance, $1,000 per hour for partners, $595 for staff. The city refused to release itemized invoices, citing attorney-client privilege. 4 days before that hearing, the Denver Sheriff's Department gave ICE 1 hour's notice before releasing Abraham Gonzalez, a 23-year-old Venezuelan national and suspected Tren de Aragua member who had been in custody for 345 days. ICE had requested 48 hours. When Gonzalez walked out, he assaulted ICE agents attempting to apprehend him, injuring at least one officer. 345 days you had him in custody, Representative Jim Jordan told Johnston at the hearing, and I said, "Hey, can you give us 48 hours heads up? You gave them 1 hour notice." On February 26, 2026, Johnston signed Executive Order 152, banning ICE from all city-owned property, including shelters, community centers, libraries, and the Denver Coliseum, without a judicial warrant, and directing Denver police to intervene and detain ICE agents using excessive force. He announced the order to the New York Times before telling local media. 5280 magazine, after examining his full record on the migrant crisis, concluded his approach was poorly conceived, disorganized, and badly executed. The American Friends Service Committee's Jennifer Piper called the rollout of the asylum seekers program disorganized. Housekeys, Action Network Denver, demanded Johnston own up to his blatant and damaging lies. He ended the program entirely in December 2024. The consequences of this posture are not theoretical. The Trump administration rescinded $24 million in FEMA grants Denver had been promised for migrant shelters. The Department of Justice sued Denver, the governor, and the state attorney general to invalidate Colorado sanctuary laws. Trump named his mass deportation program Operation Aurora after visiting the city. Former ICE agents predicted Denver would be targeted for stepped-up enforcement. Governor Jared Polis took a different approach. He rejected the sanctuary label and quietly attempted to comply with an ICE subpoena for personal data on migrant sponsors, spending $110,000 in legal fees before a Denver judge blocked the handover. Had the judge not intervened, Polis would have turned over personal identifying information on migrants who had cooperated with federal authorities. In February 2026, Polis reversed course entirely, signing an executive order limiting state cooperation with ICE. Denver and the Statehouse pursued opposite strategies. Johnston's public confrontations drew federal retaliation, while Polis's attempts at quiet compliance drew a judicial rebuke. Both approaches left Denver area residents bearing the consequences. Turning to Tren de Aragua and what actually happened in Aurora. No element of Denver's migrant crisis drew more national attention than Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan criminal organization whose presence in Aurora apartment complexes became a flashpoint in the 2024 presidential campaign. The political narrative often oscillated between two poles: Trump's claim that gangs had taken over entire cities, and local officials' assurances that the problem was exaggerated. The documented facts support neither version. What happened was worse than officials admitted and more specific than the political rhetoric suggested. Tren de Aragua was founded in 2014 inside Tocoron Prison in Venezuela's Aragua state under a government policy of handing prison control to crime bosses. The prison compound contained a zoo, a swimming pool, and a nightclub. The organization evolved from a prison gang into a transnational criminal enterprise with operations across South America and eventually the United States. The State Department designated it a foreign terrorist organization in February 2025. The DEA's acting administrator called Colorado ground zero for TDA activity in the United States. The takeover of Aurora apartment complexes is documented in detail by Perkins Coie, a major law firm retained by Property Management, whose investigator, former U.S. Attorney T.T. Marcus Funk, presented findings to Aurora leadership in August 2024. The timeline is specific. In late 2023, TDA established a presence at four CBZ management apartment complexes: Whispering Pines, Edge at Lowry, Aspen Grove, and Fitzsimons Place. In November 2023, a management consultant was beaten and hospitalized without provocation. A management representative was assaulted after refusing a bribe. In April 2024, two armed gang members attempted to kill the property manager over unpaid rent. Both were arrested with firearms. In June, the gang made a formal extortion demand, 50% of all collected rent. One gang member told management, "This is our business plan. If he doesn't like it, we'll fill him with bullets." On June 27, TDA formally informed the landlords of three complexes that the gang was now in charge. What followed was systematic. The gang broke into vacant apartments and moved people into seized units. They conducted unauthorized door-to-door rent collection, documented on video. They collected $500 biweekly from terrorized residents. Perkins Coie documented that the gang engaged in child prostitution, with a member claiming, "Minors are a good source of money." Vacant units were used for drug sales. The violence was not theoretical. In January 2024, a man was shot in the leg outside Whispering Pines. In July, a shootout at Fitzsimons Place sent two men to the hospital with gunshot wounds, and a third fell from a window trying to escape. In August 2024, roughly 10 minutes after the surveillance video that went viral nationally, showing six armed men knocking on doors to locate rivals, a shootout erupted that killed Oswaldo José de Bion Araujo, 25. In December 2024, approximately 15 to 20 armed individuals kidnapped a couple from their apartment at Edge at Lowry, dragged them to a vacant unit, and spent 5 hours pistol-whipping, questioning, robbing, and torturing them. The woman sustained injuries consistent with torture. 12 people were charged. 16 suspected TDA members were taken into ICE custody. On June 24, 2024, 8 men stormed Joyeria El Ruby, a jewelry store in Denver's West Highland neighborhood. They aimed guns at employees, beat them with firearms, and stole nearly $4 million in gold and jewelry. Two TDA members pleaded guilty and were each sentenced to 20 years in federal prison and ordered to pay $3.9 million in restitution. The federal response, when it finally came, was substantial. A 9-month undercover ATF investigation produced a 39-count indictment of 28 people, including charges of firearms trafficking, drug trafficking of methamphetamine, cocaine, and 2C, a synthetic narcotic containing ketamine, methamphetamine, and MDMA, and conspiracy to commit murder for hire. 5 defendants agreed to kill 2 people for $15,000, with an additional $5,000 promised if they returned the victim's severed heads. 69 firearms were recovered, including automatic machine guns. In December 2025, a separate RICO indictment charged T-Day leadership. One was placed on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list with a $5 million reward. After the arrests, Urapahu County Sheriff Tyler Brown reported a 75% reduction in calls for service compared with the previous year. Denver homicides fell 58% and robberies 16% in the same period. The numbers confirmed what residents had been saying. A relatively small number of individuals were responsible for a disproportionate share of criminal activity in the affected areas. The debate over how many TDA members actually operated in Colorado misses the point. Aurora Police identified 10 to 20 confirmed members. The federal indictments named 30. Whatever the precise number, the documented harm, including extortion, kidnapping, torture, murder, child exploitation, and a $4 million armed robbery, was inflicted on a community that had no say in whether these individuals entered the country. According to DHS, the vast majority of TDA victims are Venezuelan migrants. The gang preys primarily on the community it emerged from. The people who walked thousands of miles through the Darien Gap to escape Venezuela's collapse found, in some Aurora apartment complexes, the same predators they had fled. On the crime, no one can satisfactorily measure. This is the framework through which most Americans evaluate the relationship between immigration and crime. Every crime committed by someone who entered the country illegally is a crime that did not have to happen. That reasoning is not irrational. Regardless of comparative rates, these are victims who would not exist if the system had worked. The cases that drive this argument are specific and devastating. In February 2024, Lakin Riley, a 22-year-old nursing student in Georgia, was murdered by a Venezuelan national who had been apprehended at the southern border and released. Her death led directly to the Lakin Riley Act, which passed the Senate 64-35 with 12 Democrats voting yes. In 2015, Kate Steinle was shot and killed in San Francisco by a man released under the city's sanctuary policy despite an ICE detainer. Each case represents a failure of the system that costs someone their life. Texas is the only state in the country that systematically tracks crimes by immigration status. Between 2011 and January 2026, the Texas Department of Public Safety recorded 590 homicide convictions and 3,841 sexual assault convictions by undocumented immigrants. These are not estimates or projections. They are conviction records. The FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program does not record immigration status. No federal database comprehensively tracks crimes committed by unauthorized immigrants. Studies that conclude immigrants pose no elevated risk do so using a measurement system that was never designed to answer the question. What data does exist points in multiple directions. The Cato Institute, using data from 2010 to 2023, found that U.S. citizens aged 18 to 54 had an incarceration rate of 1.2%, while undocumented immigrants had a rate of 0.6% and legal immigrants 0.3%. A study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences using Texas DPS data from 2012 to 2018 found that U.S.-born citizens were more than twice as likely to be arrested for violent crimes compared with undocumented immigrants. A meta-analysis of 51 studies found statistically significant negative correlations between immigration and crime, 2.5 times as often as positive ones. But these findings are not unchallenged. The Center for Immigration Studies argues that the Texas data understates illegal immigrant crime because it takes years for the state to identify some convicts as undocumented. When CIS applied its corrections, the 2015 illegal immigrant homicide rate in Texas came out 20% higher than the state average rather than 8% lower. The honest answer is that the data is insufficient for definitive national conclusions, and both sides exploit that ambiguity. What is not ambiguous is that 590 families in Texas lost someone to homicide at the hands of a person who should not have been in the country. Whether the overall rate is lower than the native-born average is irrelevant to those families. The system's failure to prevent those deaths is a legitimate grievance, and dismissing it with comparative statistics misses the point that drives the public's anger. Turning to who pays the price. The fiscal impact of illegal immigration has a structural unfairness at its center. The costs fall on state and local governments, while the benefits accrue to the federal budget. This mismatch explains much of why working families in border states and destination cities are angry, even as economists in Washington point to net gains. The Congressional Budget Office reported in 2025 that the immigration surge drove $19.3 billion in new state and local spending in 2023, including $5.7 billion for education and $3.3 billion for emergency shelter. State and local revenue offset only $10.1 billion of that cost, primarily from sales taxes. The remaining $9.2 billion came from existing budgets, which means from services that existing residents were already using. Denver illustrates this dynamic. The city spent $79 million directly on migrant services, cut $45 million from city departments, and saw its safety net hospital close inpatient beds. Recreation centers reduced hours. Parks programming was slashed. The city's existing homeless population watched resources redirect. The costs were immediate and visible to every resident. The offsetting economic benefits, including workforce contributions, consumer spending, and tax revenue, are real but diffuse, spread across years, and largely invisible to the families absorbing the disruption. At the federal level, the math is different. The CBO found that immigration lowered federal deficits by $0.9 trillion over the 2024 to 2034 period and boosted nominal GDP by $8.9 trillion. Undocumented immigrant households paid an estimated $96.7 billion in taxes in 2022, including $25.7 billion into Social Security and $6.4 billion into Medicare, programs they are barred from accessing. More than a third of their tax dollars went to programs from which they can never benefit. The biggest fiscal beneficiary of illegal immigration is the federal government. The wage effects hit hardest at the bottom. Harvard economist George Borjas has found that immigration reduced wages for native-born workers without a high school diploma by 2% to 5%, with African-American men experiencing a 3.6% decline for each 10% increase in immigrant workers. UC Berkeley economist David Card's competing research found minimal effects on native wages. But the people in this debate are not economists. They are Americans who stock shelves, frame houses, and pick crops, the same workers already struggling with post-pandemic inflation. The labor dependency creates its own trap. An estimated 9.7 million undocumented immigrants work in the U.S. Economy, comprising 5.6% of the workforce, including an estimated 15% of construction workers and 42% of crop farm workers. Mass deportation would reduce real GDP by as much as 7.4% by 2028. Housing prices for new builds jumped 18% when mass deportations removed construction workers from local labor markets between 2008 and 2013. This is the bind. The economy depends on workers the law says should not be here. The costs of their presence fall on communities least equipped to absorb them. The benefits flow to the federal government and to employers, and the workers themselves pay into systems they cannot access. Everyone involved, from the migrants to the communities to the local governments, is paying a price for a system that serves the interests of those furthest from the consequences. On the global toll. America's struggle with illegal immigration is not unique. It is not even unusual. Every region of the world is grappling with the same forces, and the harm, both to receiving communities and to migrants themselves, follows the same patterns everywhere. In Europe, Germany registered more than 1 million asylum seekers in 2015 under Chancellor Angela Merkel's open-door policy. The consequences reshaped the continent. On New Year's Eve across Germany, crowds of men assaulted and robbed women in incidents that generated more than 1,200 criminal complaints, with the worst violence concentrated in Cologne. Of 153 suspects later identified, two-thirds were from Morocco or Algeria, and 44% were asylum seekers. A decade later, only 39 convictions resulted from over 1,200 criminal charges. In 2016 alone, a 17-year-old Afghan refugee stabbed five people on a train in Würzburg. A Syrian asylum seeker detonated a bomb in Ansbach, injuring 15, and a failed Tunisian asylum seeker drove a truck into Berlin's Breitscheidplatz Christmas market, killing 12. Germany spent 21.7 billion euros on refugee-related costs in 2016. The Alternative for Germany party rose from 4.7% of the vote in 2013 to 20.8% in 2025, becoming the country's second-largest party. Merkel herself reversed course within a year, reinstating border controls and pushing the EU-Turkey deal. Sweden's trajectory is starker. Fatal shootings nearly quadrupled from 17 in 2012 to 63 in 2022. Sweden's bomb data center recorded 149 confirmed detonations in 2023. The broader Polisen count, which includes attempts and preparations, reached 317 in 2024, down from 351 in 2023 under the same methodology, though 2025 was on pace to set a new record. Swedish police designated 65 vulnerable areas, neighborhoods where emergency services sometimes cannot enter without police escort, with 5,000 criminals and 200 criminal networks operating across them. Integration costs peaked at 64 billion Swedish kronor in 2017. The Sweden Democrats rose from 5.7% in 2010 to 20.5% in 2022, becoming the country's second-largest party. By 2024, Sweden was offering immigrants up to 350,000 kronor to voluntarily leave. In the Mediterranean, more than 28,000 people have died attempting the crossing since 2014, making it the deadliest migration route on Earth. In September 2023, 12,000 migrants arrived on the Italian island of Lampedusa in a single week, twice the island's population of 7,000. The reception center, billed for 389, held 6,000. In the UK, 194,000 people have crossed the English Channel in small boats since 2018. The cost to British taxpayers reached £4.7 billion in 2023 to 2024, with £3 billion spent housing asylum seekers in hotels. The Rwanda deportation scheme cost £715 million before cancellation and relocated exactly four people. In France, the Calais jungle camp held over 8,000 people before its 2016 demolition. Smugglers charged 3,000 to 7,000 euros per channel crossing, generating an estimated 150 million euros per year. In the Middle East, Lebanon, already teetering from a banking collapse, political crisis, and the 2020 Beirut port explosion, absorbed 1.5 million Syrian refugees, 25% of its population. Its economy contracted 53% between 2019 and 2021. Jordan spends $2.5 billion annually hosting refugees, equivalent to 6% of GDP, while its citizens face water rationing in one of the driest countries on Earth. Turkey, hosting 3.5 million Syrians at a cost of $50 billion, saw anti-refugee riots sweep across multiple cities in 2024 after rumors of a sexual assault spread on social media. In Libya, CNN documented slave auctions in 2017, where migrants were sold for as little as $400. The EU funds the Libyan Coast Guard to intercept migrants at sea and return them to detention centers where the UN has documented torture, forced labor, and sexual violence. In Africa, South Africa's xenophobic violence has killed 669 people and displaced 127,572 since 1994, with mobs burning immigrants alive while unemployment stands at 31%. Tunisia's president described sub-Saharan migrants as hordes in 2023, triggering a wave of anti-black violence. At least 27 bodies were found in the desert after mass deportations to the Libyan border. Algeria has abandoned more than 36,000 deportees in the Sahara in a single year. In East Africa, Bangladesh, one of the world's poorest countries, hosts nearly a million Rohingya refugees who have stripped 8,000 acres of forest and driven local wages down by half. Killings within the camps rose from 22 in 2021 to 90 in 2023. Abductions rose from 91 in 2022 to 446 in 2024. In the Americas, the Darien Gap, a 60-mile stretch of roadless jungle between Colombia and Panama, controlled by criminal networks including Colombia's Clan del Golfo, has become the Western Hemisphere's deadliest migration corridor. More than 500,000 people crossed in 2023, a record, with 302,000 following in 2024. Doctors Without Borders documented 1,500 reports of sexual violence between April 2021 and March 2024. The IOM's Missing Migrants Project recorded at least 245 people who disappeared in the crossing between 2021 and 2024, a figure widely considered an undercount, given the impenetrable terrain. In Southeast Asia, the AP's Pulitzer Prize-winning investigation found Burmese and Cambodian migrants enslaved on Thai fishing boats, locked in cages, surviving on small portions of rice while working 20-hour shifts. More than 2,000 were freed. In Cambodia and Myanmar, an estimated 300,000 people are trapped in Chinese-run scam compounds, up from 220,000 just 2 years earlier, according to the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. They are forced to work 16-hour days running cryptocurrency fraud operations under threat of electrocution, organ harvesting, and sexual violence. The industry generates $50 to $75 billion annually. In Singapore, migrant workers accounted for 94% of all COVID-19 infections, 49,327 of 52,205 cases, after being packed 10 to 20 per room in dormitories, the country preferred not to see. The pattern is the same everywhere. Uncontrolled migration overwhelms communities that lack the capacity to absorb it. The costs fall on the poorest residents of the receiving countries. Criminal networks profit. Politicians exploit the backlash, and the migrants themselves suffer the most, drowned in the Mediterranean, sold in Libyan slave markets, tortured in Cambodian compounds, shot in Aurora apartments. In every case, the gap between the scale of human movement and the capacity of institutions to manage it produced the same result, suffering distributed to those with the least power to avoid it. Turning to where things stand now. President Trump's second term has produced the most dramatic shift in immigration enforcement in modern history. On his first day in office, January 20, 2025, he declared a national emergency at the southern border, ended the catch-and-release policy, and directed the military to seal the borders. He signed an executive order to end birthright citizenship, which two federal judges immediately blocked. The Supreme Court is expected to rule by mid-2026. The Lake and Riley Act, signed January 29, 2025, mandates detention of undocumented immigrants charged with burglary, theft, shoplifting, or assault. ICE agents were permitted to conduct enforcement operations at schools, hospitals, and places of worship, reversing Biden-era protections. The administration invoked the Alien Enemies Act, unused since World War II, to deport suspected gang members to El Salvador's Saycot prison. Military cargo planes were used for deportation flights. For the first time, migrants arrested on U.S. soil were sent to Guantanamo Bay. The results were swift. Southwest border apprehensions in March 2025 fell to 7,181, a 95% decrease from March 2024. ICE arrests quadrupled. Nearly 69,000 people sat in ICE detention. Refugee admissions were set for a record low of 7,500 in 2026, down from a cap of 125,000. in Colorado, ICE arrested 3,522 people between January 20 and October 15, 2025, quadrupling the number from the same period the previous year. Most of those arrested had no prior criminal convictions, according to ICE data, suggesting that enforcement was sweeping up more people without criminal records. A federal judge issued a preliminary injunction prohibiting ICE from making warrantless arrests in Colorado. But the ACLU filed a 98-page complaint alleging continued violations. Community impacts have been immediate. Reports from across the state describe immigrants afraid to go to work, send their children to school, or leave their homes. The fear extends to legal residents and citizens in mixed-status families. Multiple federal judges, including some appointed by Trump, have blocked various administration policies. The legal battles will likely define immigration law for years to come. The data from every democracy examined in this article converges on the same conclusion. People are not anti-immigrant, they are anti-chaos. They support legal immigration because it implies a system that works, screening, quotas, integration, mutual benefit. They oppose illegal immigration because it represents the failure of that system, a failure whose costs are borne by the communities least equipped to absorb them and by the migrants themselves, who walk thousands of miles through jungles controlled by cartels only to arrive in cities that cannot house their own residents. In Denver, $356 million produced a shelter system the city auditor could not account for and an asylum program that served 2% of arrivals. In Aurora, a handful of gang members terrorized apartment complexes for months before anyone with authority acted. In Germany, an open-door policy in 2015 fueled the rise of the far right across the continent. In Lebanon, 1.5 million refugees helped tip a fragile state into economic collapse. In Bangladesh, 1 million Rohingya stripped 8,000 acres of forest and overwhelmed one of the world's poorest countries. Everywhere, the pattern repeats. Compassion without capacity produces suffering for everyone. The 79% of Americans who say immigration is a good thing for this country are not contradicting the 78% who call the border a crisis. They are describing the same demand, a system that lets people in through the front door and locks the back one. No government has built that system, not America's, not Europe's, not anyone's. Until one does, the anger will continue. The walls will keep going up, and the people caught in the middle will keep paying the highest price of all. And now, Kim's perspective. If you want to become a citizen of this country, you should do it the right way, legally, and the data makes clear the process desperately needs an overhaul. 19 to 24-year waits for Mexican applicants and a 90-year backlog for some Indian workers is not a system. It is a bureaucratic hostage situation. But a broken process does not excuse ignoring it. Texas is the only state that actually tracks crimes by immigration status, and its data shows 590 homicide convictions and 3,841 sexual assault convictions by undocumented immigrants since 2011. Studies that conclude there is no problem because they lack the data to draw conclusions from are not reassuring. They are an indictment of how little we bother to measure. 55% of Americans want immigration reduced, 78% call the border a crisis, and the Lake and Riley Act passed with bipartisan support because Americans are paying attention even when researchers are not. The biggest beneficiary of illegal immigration is the same government that refuses to fix it, vacuuming up the tax dollars and hard work of citizens and non-citizens alike while delivering a broken system to both. Undocumented working immigrants paid $25.7 billion into Social Security and $6.4 billion into Medicare, programs they can never access. The transfer of wealth from the American middle class to pay for programs and services for dependent illegal immigrants is making the American dream unattainable for many everyday, hardworking Americans. Using both common sense and compassion, it is time to fix this. This article is available at kimmonson.com. For the full article with sources and links, visit kimmonson.com. This has been a Kim Monson National News Briefing.